Welcome to Vistage Live, the place you can come to for insights, knowledge and perspectives from a range of experts who can help your small and mid-sized business make a great big impact. Our guest today is Anthony Bonici, keynote speaker, coach, mentor, and creator of the acclaimed Brain Blinkers program. For more than 20 years, Anthony has inspired teams and leaders around the world to move mountains. Before launching his global speaking business, he spent 13 years in sales, marketing, and people leadership roles within the pharmaceutical industry, leading brands worth over $150 million and transforming middle-of-the-road sales teams into high-performing ones. Anthony is also a certified NLP master practitioner and lifelong performer. He blends psychology, storytelling, and practical tools to help people remove the brain blinkers that hold him back. If you've missed your morning coffee today, you'll be fine because you're about to get a great shot of energy. Anthony Bonici, welcome to Vistage Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Yes, we were saying we can't believe you've never been on Vistage.
Remarkable. I've been doing this with you guys for so many years and then I got this little invitation. I thought, absolutely.
Great. Well, it's great to have you here and I think you'll be a regular guest.
Excellent. Happy.
So the idea of brain blinkers. Tell us about that.
Oh, wow. Gosh. You said only half an hour, right?
Yeah.
We'll spend 30 minutes on it. No. It has the idea of the mental blocks.
Yeah.
Of mental barriers to high performance, whether it's sport, family life, professional life, has always intrigued me. And I read widely when I was young about this sort of area and came up with the idea of putting it in my own language. Mm. And I remember I was jogging a circuit with my wife way back then before kids. And I said, I've got this idea. I want to put it into practice and I want to help people identify and remove these three key mental barriers. I said, but I can't call the book Identifying and Removing the Three Key Mental Barriers. It has to have that line. And Julie, my beautiful wife, said, they're brain blinkers. Mm. And I remember I physically stopped as I was running and just stopped and went, I've never heard a more perfect title. And from then on, that was it. We came up with the logo really quickly. The book got written and it's been my keynote for 20 years now.
And it's the whole idea of the blinkers on a horse.
Correct. And if anyone from North America or indeed the UK listening to this, blinders, you know, it's commonly referred to as brain blinders or blinkers. In Australia, we call them blinkers, but they're blinders in other parts of the world. And it is that idea of blinding ourselves or blinkering ourselves to what's possible because we get in ruts, we get in ways of thinking, we get in channels of beliefs that preclude us from seeing other alternatives. And that's the idea. So my mission for the last 20 years, the mandate, and that's why I've still got the same energy, probably more energy now than I did when I started, the work is always there to be done to help people figure out what those blinkers are, all those blinders are, and then help them remove them in a really simple way.
So, and I'm familiar with it, which is why we're chatting. How did your work in sales?
Yes.
And in sales leadership and sales enablement, how did that kind of inform what you ended up looking for?
It's from its simplest piece. As a sales rep myself, you know, banging my head against a brick wall with a particular customer and then, you know, sort of trudging up the next time to go, oh, here we go again. Like I'm not going to be able to get in to see this customer or this customer never listens to me or access is hard or we don't have a good enough product.
The market's bad.
The
weather's terrible.
The weather's terrible. Friday's not a good day. Monday's not a good day. Wednesday's not a good day. So all of this stuff just gets into our head, rightly or wrongly. And one thing, when we do the brain blinkers work, don't judge it. It just happens. That's what it is. And that level of acceptance, first up, to accept that you actually have it is critical to then say, right, if I've got it, I'll own it. This is what I'm saying. I'm saying that Fridays are bad or that I can't get in to see this customer. And so my sales changed when I started changing this. And that for me was the first bit of, I guess, impetus into knowing, oh gosh, there's a lot to this. It wasn't my sales skill. It wasn't my product knowledge. It wasn't my territory or business knowledge that was holding me back. It was really fundamental, but I was blind to it, beliefs that I couldn't get through to this particular customer. So addressing that, first and foremost, created massive change in what I did. So the whole premise is shift the belief to shift the behavior. That's what's really underneath it.
It's really good. Before we get into some specifics of what are the most common brain blinkers you've uncovered, I love the story you tell about when you're in, you know, serious sales leadership and the target, the kind of unachievable target you were given. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, well, this refers to probably the most common brain blinker, which we call limiting beliefs, is the number one brain blinker, I guess, that we speak about. And in the sales context, that idea that the target is too high, you know what I mean? So the beginning of a sales year, and I personally experienced this when I progressed through to sales leadership roles and then into a marketing and commercialization role, you know, 200 people in a room, it's the beginning of the year, you're there to motivate them to achieve the target and you put the number up and they sit there and look at you as if to say, I can't hit that target. And it's January. You've got 11 more months in front of you, right? And irrespective of the resource you give someone, the skills, the money, anything, if they in their heart of hearts believe it's not possible, their body, their actions will find a way of making that come true, even though it's not what they want. They actually want to hit their target. I don't know a salesperson that doesn't want to hit their target. It's just that they don't believe, a lot of people don't believe it's possible at all. So getting into that belief and saying, righto, if the belief is I can't hit the target, what might be a better belief than that? The target's going to be tough, but with this effort, we can maybe target these people. Or just to bring that back a bit, that's one of the tools that we talk about is how do you make the belief, the limiting belief, a bit better?
And what could be a better belief?
So, for example, if the target's impossible, the target's too high, you could a better belief, and it depends on the context of the sales industry, of course, too, is to say that with increased effort in this particular thing, I reckon we could increase our efforts by 50%. Or the target is possible if we had extra this. So it's just a reframe. It's a reframe of the thing. The big thing that we talk about when we talk about reframing or making that belief better is not to make it diametrically opposite. So, for example, what you don't do is say, oh, the target's easy.
Yeah.
Because your subconscious goes, no, it's not.
Which is actually where a lot of salespeople will go.
Yes.
That bad optimism.
Spot on.
It's wrong word, but overly optimistic.
Overly optimistic.
We'll nail it.
Yeah, exactly.
Hit it. We'll smash it.
But they're it's naive. It's almost, you know, it's ridiculous. So making the limiting belief a bit better. Mm. So it's at the I call it at the margin, working it at the margin. And groups, I mean, that's what I do when I'm speaking. I'll help people tailor in to what that industry, what that specific sales team or salesperson needs to do to reframe and make that belief a little bit better. And that's the art of it. And it's practice. It's small things. So I can't lose weight. I can't run a marathon. I can't learn a language. There's so many beliefs that we
have. I've said to you, I can't do Wordle.
Can't do Wordle.
That was my self-limiting belief.
Right. And we used that in the example. You were very kind enough to share that with a whole bunch
of.
I got
some funny looks.
Like. You did. And because I'd not heard of it in 20 years. I know Wordle very well. But it's any of those. And if you hold them, any that we've just discussed, if you hold them true, you might say, yes, but it's true. You're bad at Wordle or, you know, the target is too high.
You can't run.
Or you can't run or, you don't know how to speak Spanish. The trick is not letting the current belief get in the way of it changing. That's the thing. There's almost an acceptance where you need to say, right, this is holding me back. What am I going to do about it, that call to action? And the first step is to reframe it.
Reframe it into a better belief.
Better belief.
So what are some of the other self-limiting or brain blinkers bring to work?
Yeah, there's one that we summarize, and I know you like this one, into the coffee model, COFFEE. And it's an acronym, of course, for six ways that we self-sabotage. So we've just spoken briefly now about limiting beliefs. But the second and very common form of brain blinkers, if you like, is self-sabotage, where it's almost like a little sort of devil on your shoulder, just nipping in your ear, you know, just reminding you of how bad you are. It's self-sabotage. It's very self-explanatory. And we call it coffee because the six letters, COFFEE. C is for catastrophize. So that's when we make things worse than they actually are. This is the not crying over spilt milk thing. It's, you know, you've had a great day and then something small happens and that's the thing that really tips you over the edge. Really easy to spot. We call people drama queens, a very misogynistic term. There's no evidence that it's gender-based at all. So we talk about identifying when you've got moments of catastrophizing. And the thing with that the first of those six things of self-sabotage is that catastrophizing is not only just not good for you, it's not good for everyone around you, particularly if you're listening to this as a leader of people. That's the core one, right? Because people, when they have a leader who is catastrophizing, that they are likely to feel tense, not want to contribute, not give their best, keep out of trouble, you know, because they're fearful of the response. Mm. So there's a mandate as a leader to not catastrophize. So we talk about that. So that's the C. I'll go through them quickly because we could be here all day. But the second in coffee is about overgeneralizing. So that's all the isms that we face in the world, are racism, sexism, all people with this color skin, or all people from this particular suburb or this particular industry, all accountants are boring, you know.
Or all deals that look like this go wrong.
Spot on.
Or all customers in this industry.
I like this. Spot on. That's exactly it, Stephanie, which is understanding that you have a generalization, but overgeneralizing makes everyone, you know, it's that whole blanket approach, the 100% off. And the fact is, not everyone in that industry or not all customer types like that are going to act like that. They won't. 70% might. I'm choosing a number. You can choose whatever number you want. But, you know, if you say, you know, everyone does it and only 7 out of 10 do, then you're wrong 3 times out of 10 and that's going to cost you. Mm. So that idea of overgeneralizing, very dangerous. Then we've got F for filtering, which is choosing to remember and take on board what you want. And filtering is a bit of a spectrum. It's positive or negative and sort of everything in between. So people who are negative filterers are really hard on themselves because all they're listening for is the negative. They're just listening for the hard stuff because they've got the idea, and I guess there's some element of truth to it, which is that when you give me constructive criticism or feedback, I can improve that. So they look for it, they listen for it, but they're selectively listening for it. They're not hearing any of the positive, right? And I hope you're sitting there thinking, yeah, well, that's good, isn't it? But longer term, that can be masochistic. You can be doing it to really beat yourself up. So it can be dangerous in that respect.
Especially if you're going to catastrophize or overgeneralize.
Yeah, and this is where they come together.
I always get it wrong.
Yeah.
My boss said I got it wrong. I always get it wrong.
You got it.
Yeah.
So these are not in isolation, as you've just pointed out. The filtering can be with catastrophizing easily. But then you've also got people who positively filter. And that's where we think, oh, it's probably better. Is it better to positively filter? No. These are people who are delusional quite often. They're the people who hear the positive and all they hear is positive. They're not hearing any of the constructive feedback, so they don't get anything.
Yeah.
So that's a dangerous one. The second F in coffee is to forecast negatively or predict failure before it even has the chance to arrive. So you know that idea that you're going to, I mean, if you look at the sales context again, and I remember as a general practitioner sales rep, I'd go and see primary care physicians back in the day in the early 90s promoting Prozac, my goodness me, when it was first launched as a novel antidepressant. And you go and try and see this customer and you've been in 3 times before and not been successful. There's a part of you that forecasts or predicts, I'm not going to get in today. And what happens? You don't get in today. Yeah. And that reinforces the belief. Whereas to break that is to go, shift that and go, righto, today might be my lucky day. Or today I've got a really good reason, I'm going to make sure I get in. That's one way to break that negative forecasting sort of way of thinking. The last two are E's, and the second last letter of, or the second last word is to emotionalize. And that really means to take things personally. A dangerous thing to do, it's a form of self-sabotage when we take it personally. We're not able to separate what we do or what we've done from who we are. So the good example here, parents, right? So as a parent, I've got 4 of the little monkeys. They're not little anymore, but when they were little and they do something naughty, it's the easiest thing in the world is to reprimand them by saying, hey, naughty boy, right? That you did that naughty. Whereas what I'm doing is I'm labeling the child and I'm making him believe he's naughty. I don't want that. What I want is him not to do the naughty thing. So when we talk about not emotionalizing, it's not taking it personally. Make it about the thing, not you. So, for example, when you fail, like we all do, right? Instead of feeling like a failure, what we do is we say, I failed, and recognize that. What am I going to do about that? I've got to work out what I'm going to do. But I'm not a failure. You know, I choked, but I'm not a choker. I made a mistake, but I'm not the mistake. So not owning the negative behavior, that you've exhibited. That's the example of emotionalizing. And the last one is a word, Stephanie, that I've been using for 20 years that does not exist in the English language. And I take pride when I put it up. And I remember the first time I put it up many, many years ago, and there were a couple of lawyers in the room, and they, before I could say anything, they said, that's not a word.
Not a word.
It's not. I call it effectualize, and it's a silly word, but it's really, it speaks of a very simple concept, which is to be at the effect of something rather than at the cause. Smith, Hickman and Connor wrote a book about 30 years ago called The Oz Principle. And that book is not really known by its original name, The Oz Principle. It's called about the Wizard of Oz, etc., the Yellow Brick Road and all of this. But what it talks about is what it's known, which is above or below the line thinking. And this is the last piece, I guess, of the puzzle in terms of self-sabotage. People who are at the effect of things are called below the line. And we've all got them. You've got them in families. You've got them in businesses. It might be in your immediate sort of area of control where someone is always whinging, complaining, poor me, it always happens to me. And they're fixed and focused on the problem. Okay. And that's called being below the line. Now, the thing is, when you're there, it is nearly impossible. I'm going to say it is impossible to come up with a solution to the problem because your brain is fixated on the problem. So what we've got to do is do something to get that person what's called from below the line to above it. And the way to do that is to focus on action. So for example, if you haven't got enough resources and you're behind plan, we use the sales analogy again, it's easy for people to go, oh yeah, we'll never get there. It always happens to me. Every company I go to, all the whinging, the victim mentality, not my problem. It's the marketing guys didn't give me enough promotional material.
Always.
All leadership, they don't provide us any, we're always, when you're there, recognize that you're below the line. Stop and then say, okay, have I got the right problem? Do I know what the right problem is? Is it really resource? Is it really how I'm being treated? Whatever it might be. And what it does, that starts to get you less emotional and more fact-based on what the actual problem is. That is actually helpful. Then once you've decided, or the team, you can do this for an individual or a team, once you've decided what that problem is, differentially diagnosed it, then you say, right, what can I or we do as a result of this problem to fix it? And that forces a brain to go what's called above the line. Mm-hmm. And when you're above the line, you're at cause. You're not focusing your energy on the impact of the problem. You're focusing your energy on what we can do as a result. And I've used this methodology in coaching, in mentoring, in group sessions, training, facilitation, sports field. It is remarkable. Even my local cricket team, we talked about this. Why is our bowling impotent? What are we doing? Or why is our fielding poor? It's this specific thing. Right. What are we going to do about it? Okay. Next training session is 2 hours and we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Funny thing happens that the fielding improves the next week, right? So getting above the line and saying, what can I do? Or what can we do, depending if it's a team or not, to change this, gets the brain focused on a solution. So one of the worst things you can do when people are down and below the line is to say, hey, come on, we've all got to come up with a solution.
Yeah.
No.
Don't bring me problems. Just bring me solutions.
I hear that a lot. Yeah. It's actually better to say, let's make sure we've got the right problem. Once we've got the right problem, no one's allowed to talk about the problem anymore. Because what we're going to be doing is focusing on what we're going to do as a result of this.
It's so powerful and we know about it because we do a lot of Vistage, but identifying the real problem is so powerful.
Yeah. It's one step even further, which is it is fundamental to attack. Because without the right problem, you're going to be going in circles because you're attacking the wrong thing. So it is fundamental to get that differential diagnosis right of what the problem is. And this is one of the biggest misconceptions of that wonderful model above and below the line. Everyone says, oh, don't go below the line. Just spend their time in solution mode. That's nuts. Because what you actually need to do is actually go below the line, just visit there, don't stay. Go there and say, what is our problem? Let's get really laser focused on what that is. So that's one thing when I tell leaders, hey, you got to get below the line. Just don't stay there. that sticks with them.
That's really good. Yeah. Really interesting. I do love the coffee model. I love the self-limiting beliefs, and I love the coffee model because there's so much in there.
Yeah.
And right. I try not to use it as a checklist of, yeah, I do that, I do that.
Oh, yeah. That is a really common thing that people do, which is if you're a leader and you're focused on getting the right results, you'll look inwards, you'll start to, you know, identify in self, maybe emotionalize a little bit. Oh, is that what I'm doing?
Yeah, totally.
It's there as a guide for self and others to help you be at your best. And once you're done, you might have one of these things that is your little Achilles heel, or you might have a couple that live together, and making small changes in that can have a profound effect on the behavior.
So how do you do that? Because somehow you're wired, so say overgeneralization.
Yes.
Somehow you're wired in whatever you believe wiring comes from.
Yes.
And it's kind of pathways that are reinforced because you overgeneralize and you overgeneralize again. How can you, so using that example, can you make a small step to?
So with if you pick on overgeneralizing, you know, you're quick to judge people, you know, from that suburb or that, you know, university or school or whatever. Part of it's genetic, let's face it, because we're built to actually do that and protect ourselves.
Bias is inbuilt into us in some way or another.
Confirmed, conscious, unconscious bias. There's so many biases that we have. So the first step is to actually say, is it something you want to change? And it's that, like we said earlier on, it's that acknowledgement of, is this something that if it changed, could it make an impact on me? And for some things, it might not. And I'm a big believer in the sense that don't bother putting in effort into something that's not going to have benefit for you.
Yeah.
But if you honestly believe that if I overgeneralize less, I'll have a better outcome personally and professionally, then that's the first step, that acceptance. Right, I'm going to do something about it. The second step is to make real, practical and small changes over an extended period of time. And that's the key. It's not just waking up going, oh, I'm not going to overgeneralize anymore. I've got a new tool. No chance of it changing. They reckon, and the data from, I think it was 2011, London College did a proper study in understanding how long it takes to shift habits. Neural connections, 100 billion neurons, you know, we haven't got time to get into all that. But the idea that once that's established, and it might be, your overgeneralizing might be established over 30 years. That's a really firm connection you've got there. So in order to break it and make a new one, it takes effort. And that effort is daily addressing of the change of the link. So for example, it would mean almost like a mantra waking up each morning going, I no longer believe that people from this school are like this or people from this area. My new belief is this, that I'm going to wait for people to prove me wrong. That's a simple one, right? I'm going to wait for people to prove me wrong. And that, and you wake up every day, and they reckon it, that London College thing, it's 2 to 3 months worth of work every single day to shift that wiring. So some people can do it in weeks. Some people it might take 6 months. The bottom line is if it's important enough for you, you'll find the time and the process to do that. And that's what we focus on with our Brain Blinkers methodology, which is make the process happen. Make it work for you from day one. It's not a quick fix. It really isn't.
No.
It's a lot of effort.
So what impact has the research that you've done, the conversations you've had with so many people over the last 20 years, what impact has that had on you, Anthony? Oh,
personally, there's nothing better for me than to get an email from a client. And, you know, it's tens of thousands or sometimes hundreds of thousands of people a year that can be in a room or rooms, I should say, right across the globe. And to get an email from someone saying, I've managed to have a better conversation with my wife about what I need, or I've realized how I've been behaving with my child who is now 18 and we've had a discussion and this has changed. Or a sales rep who said, oh my gosh, I've had a 50% jump in sales. Whatever that is, there is nothing that fills my heart more. And it just shows me that even though it's been 20 years talking, not the same thing, obviously it's moving, it's a moving beast, but this message of helping people identify stuff that's in their way, helping them remove it, it will be my life passion. And it just keeps reinforcing me, this is so important to continue to do. So it keeps me going. I have to use it every day, of course. Am I perfect? Goodness me. I remember even recently talking about things like I choked in a couple of things. Like I got to a moment in sport again and choked and thought, geez, am I a choker? And then, hang on, let's practice what we preach here. So for me to be able to use it on a daily basis is important for me to be honestly honest with what I'm talking about. But more importantly, the mission, the mandate to help people of all sorts, leaders of people, salespeople, technical, it doesn't matter your role, kids. I do a lot of work with kids where we can get in early with that young group. I'm a hopeless studier, or I'm bad at maths, you know. I love that where even though they've been bad at maths, I can get some kids who come back after a session and go, I don't have that belief anymore. And a funny thing happened with my grades in maths, you know, that keeps me ticking.
It's really good. I must get onto Wordle, but I haven't got time. I'm doing all the other puzzles.
It's not important for you.
It's not important. I'm doing all the other puzzles. What differences, because you do speak internationally.
Yes.
What differences do you see across geographies, if any?
There's cultural differences. There are.
Yeah.
Not just from a performance perspective, like how you show up and how you communicate that. The social norms, the understanding of hierarchy in some Asian countries, self-deprecation, you know, and that is part of my storytelling technique. That's accepted differently. Essentially, though, and I've spoken widely in Asia, the North America, Europe, fundamentally we're human. Fundamentally, we are all of the same make. We are. And that means we have insecurities, we have fears, we have beliefs that guide our behavior. So underneath the cultural changes and norms, underneath that is a solid mass of understanding that we are all the same. And we will catastrophize, and we will overgeneralize, and we will filter, and we have limiting beliefs, etc. So that always, once you accept and work with the cultural differences of people, and as a speaker and a facilitator, disarming people to say, I'm not here to tell you what to do. That's not what I'm here to do. What I'm here to do is to show you that with a little bit of understanding of self, it is remarkable what can happen. That message is in every audience. I've been very fortunate to have spoken in places like Mexico, where I'll never forget a Latin American conference where I was being simultaneously translated into Portuguese and Spanish. Two amazing, wonderful women doing the simultaneous translation for about 200 people in the room. They all had headphones on, and I slowed down how I was speaking, of course. But they all came up, and all these wonderful leaders were giving me cuddles and things and speaking in Portuguese that I don't understand in Spanish. And it connected for them. It worked because underneath everything is a humanity to what we're talking about.
What a great message. And I'm not going to say finish. I'm going to say pause.
Excellent.
Because there's so much.
Oh, there's much.
And I love hearing the message, because maybe this is part of my 3-month changing or whatever, how many years I've known you, Anthony. But just to hear it again really reinforces some really great takeaways.
Oh, excellent.
You know, as far as humans go, you're a great human.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful to hear what you had to bring to us today. So thank you so much for joining us, and thank you very much, Anthony Bonici, for having spent the time with us this morning.
Absolute pleasure, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Cheers.
So that's it for Vistage Live today. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you subscribe so you can listen to us each episode. And for more information about Vistage, check us out on vistage.com.au.